Senator, why haven't you endorsed anyone in the Buffalo mayoral primary or mayoral race yet? Your colleagues, Senator Bernie Sanders, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, have all endorsed India Walton, who won the Democratic primary. And do you believe that whoever wins the Democratic primary is a Democratic nominee?
Today's a day to talk about what's going on in Washington. It's not a day for politics.
Have you decided then when you're going
It's not a day for politics. I'm talking about what's going on in Washington.
So
other questions? Any on that subject? Yes. Others, next subject. Okay. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. Thank you for coming. And we're going to fight to get you the money. Enjoy your lunch. Thank you.
I think it then leads you to the question, is it always a requirement of a Democratic elected official or perhaps the state chair or party chairs, is it a requirement that if someone wins the Democratic primary, they must always get the Democratic endorsement of these people? And that's a question I would answer, no, it's not. Look, let's take a scenario very different. Where David Duke, remember him, the Grand Wizard of the KKK? He moves to New York, he becomes a Democrat, and he runs for mayor in the city of Rochester, which has a low primary turnout, and he wins the Democratic line. I have to endorse David Duke? I don't think so. Now, of course, India Walton isn't in the same category, but it just leads you to that question, is it a must? It's not a must. It's something you choose to do. That's why it's an endorsement. Otherwise, they'd call it something else, like a requirement.
There it is, episode 41. Yesterday's Man, Today Sleepy Joe, and the Demon Rats featuring Bronco Marchetich. And a couple Demon Rats right there. Just a note to Chuck Schumer. I mean, not that, you know, I'm not a professional like you are, leader of the Senate majority. But if you don't want it to be politics, then maybe don't make a pro forma endorsement process one that you have to be like, I wonder if we're going to endorse her. I don't know. Let's see. Hello, David. And by the way, you're on mute, just so you know.
Oh, no. I've been paying attention to Matt's chats behind the scene. I'm still learning the new system. I'm used to having to drive this thing. but yeah, really excited for tonight's show. We'll be joined in a couple minutes by Bronco. And a little bit later, we're going to be talking a little bit more in depth about this India Walton situation. And a little bit later in the show, we're going to be talking about Venezuela, giving people kind of crash course in how the media manufactures consent. But really looking forward to tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be exciting. But first, we should, before we move quickly to Bronco. So Jonah Furman is reporting here, among others, an injunction against striking UAW members at Deere's Davenport Works assigned by Judge Marlita Grieve. Jonah comments, freedom of assembly except when corporate America says no. Now, I thought this following exchange was kind of interesting in terms of, you know, discourse. So a guy named Work Law Prof, who I don't think is Work Law on our side, maybe I'm wrong with that, but this is just my surmise. Thanks. Paragraph 7, the obvious is obviously the key. Lots of alleged misconduct. Jonah says, what part of it is misconduct? Sounds like normal picket line to me. Trespassing sounds like code for being on company property, which the whole lot presumably is, and there's no sidewalk. Somebody else comments, nothing in here suggests that the judge had any evidentiary hearing or did any other fact-finding. This is likely based on nothing but Deere's own statements. And Jeff comes back, right, that's because it was for a preliminary injunction. The union can go back to court and try to show the judge that she should modify or lift the injunction now. So all's fair, right? Right, David?
Yeah, it's all's fair. I mean, it's just the nerve of people like that to sit here and act like we don't understand, for example, the legal process. No doubt they can challenge us in court, and that's their right, and they will do it. But the reason that companies do this kind of thing is to try to gum up the picket line, to make it difficult for people to stay on strike, right? I mean, like to just act like that is just an immaterial aspect, right? The fact that people have to stop, or sorry, that they have to limit the amount of people who can be on the picket line is just absurd.
Yeah,
I don't know. It really represents a kind of like a class of people who all of these kind of problems are just abstract to them.
Yes. Yeah, and time is not on your side, as the Rolling Stones said. And yeah, it's just so, it's so transparent. Yeah, you can go ahead and give it a shot. Like, I mean, and so what this is saying, you know, you can only put four people on that corner and four people on that corner and no more, and then confine the type of activities you can do, all for like safety of everybody, right? And really, whose safety is it? Is for the bosses.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, and there's going to be a lot more to come in sort of breaking down these strike stories across the country. I talked about it a bit yesterday on my stream. I just want to let people know who are watching on YouTube. We have put in the body of the show notes today, a bunch of different places where you can donate to strike funds. This is something that is really important. You know, usually when we have any kind of call to action, it certainly is important, but these specifically are crucial if you are serious about trying to rebuild a labor movement in the U.S. You know, people talk a really big game about all the things that we want to do, but if we are not able to materially support people in moments like this, you know, then we certainly are not doing our job. So this is a really great time if you have the ability to donate, to go down into the body of this of the YouTube video and to find one of these strike funds to support.
Yeah, exactly. For folks that, you know, don't want to take some a voting day off and not go to the ballot box, I totally agree. I understand that impulse on that day. Today's your day to build up that, you know, don't have to vote for a couple days if you do something really big here, I think.
I think that's fair. Well, shall we bring in our first guest here?
Let's do it. Yeah.
Yeah. So joining us this evening, we have a Bronco Marchetich. Joining us today. I hope I got the last name all right. I've been hearing a few different brother. Thank
you. That was pretty good. Joining us. That'll be in the top 10, I'd say.
Yeah, man. I'm happy to be there. Well, I've been really looking forward to having you on this show to sort of break down, you know, Joe Biden, both his history and what he means today. I just wanted to share really quickly, a funny story about your book, which people should definitely read, Yesterday's Man. I can't remember exactly when, but I was with Crystal Ball and she was talking about your book and saying that the first time I think that she talked to you or sometime that she talked to you, she was feeling a little, you know, sorry that you had just written this book. It got published and it looked like, you know, Joe Biden was going to come nowhere near, you know, winning the Democratic primary. And then a few months later, of course, she ends up winning and then ends up becoming the president. So you were very prescient on that.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's funny because people have said this to me before, that they kind of felt bad that I'd written this book. But to me, I was very glad. I mean, I'd written this book about how this guy was had this terrible political history and how he was uniquely ill-suited, perhaps, to take power at this particular time. And then, you know, he's losing just horribly, primary after primary. So I was very pleased. And then, of course, when he came back in South Carolina, the day after, I believe, that the book officially launched, it was like some sort of you know, cosmic practical joke on my part. But yeah, there we go.
Yeah, no, you're going to win both ways because you had it in the title, Yesterday's Man, right? So like, what do you want from me? I told you it was Yesterday's Man. But then it comes true. And I think like anybody who's surprised by, you know, we're going to get into this, but surprised by Joe's inaction in office wouldn't have been surprised if they had read your book. And I think going back and reading it now is very illuminating for where we've ended up.
Yeah, I mean, thank you. I guess we'll get into it, but I was pretty, for the first 3 months, I was kind of happy to seem like I was kind of wrong. I thought, okay, maybe he's sort of outdoing expectations. He's not, you know, nearly gone to the lengths that I would have expected Bernie Sanders to go, but, you know, going well above what I would have expected Joe Biden to go. And then since then, it's sort of settled in and about where I'd always expected it was going to go, sadly.
Well, maybe a way to start this off is there's this piece by Josh Marshall, and it looks like we're zeroing in on what's going to eventually be the bill, and it's probably be something like half the $3.5 trillion that was, you know, I guess agreed or not half agreed upon, some sort of Schrodinger-like agreement. But Josh Marshall had a section here, David, and I'll put this up. Mm-hmm. This paragraph here, which I think really encapsulates what the frustration people have with the Democratic Party. And Josh writes this: I confess that I have completely given up on making sense of what is going on the Capitol. So, I mean, people should maybe stop Bree and Josh. But is there going to be a reconciliation bill? Is the BIF going to pass? I have no idea. I'm going to skip a little bit forward. That is, to put it mildly, deeply unfortunate because the public is drifting away from the president and his party in significant part because they cannot seem to act on an agenda they say is so important. They are also sowing a creeping disillusionment and demoralization among their own partisans. This is fundamentally the fault of Democratic voters who missed the chance to elect two or four more senators last November. But the problem is Joe Biden's to solve. So there's a little stop to the end at, okay, I guess the buck stop does there, but only if only the, you know, the fucking voters pulled their finger out and saved us from this.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you lose Josh Marshall, you've kind of lost the most hardcore partisan base of your party. You know, I mean, Josh Marshall's been a pretty fierce cheerleader for Biden and the kind of more establishment wing of the Democratic Party for a while. So the fact that even he is saying stuff that I think people on the left have been saying for some time now, I think just shows you how, you know, I think we can give up all pretenses to, you know, that there being a kind of 12th dimensional chess being played here, there being some sort of wider strategy. It's, you know, it is exactly the kind of floundering failure that it appears to be.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, when looking back in hindsight, you know, what Joe Biden sort of ended up representing was he was just like, I don't know, it wasn't like a glorious embodiment, but he was the embodiment of the Democratic Party. He was just sort of like the neutral option for, you know, people who are in that machine to shout for at the end of the day, which I think is why a lot of people on the left sort of had a difficult time understanding and sort of seeing him coming to power. I mean, you know, Michael Brooks was very prescient on that early on, was saying when people were sort of writing Joe Biden off, Michael was always saying that Joe Biden was the biggest threat to Bernie. But before we focus too much on this year and the year before, I was wondering if you could sort of give us a kind of brief history of Joe Biden. Like, where does he sort of come from within, you know, the Democratic Party movement? What was his record as a senator? I mean, we don't have time to go through everything, but just sort of give people an understanding because he's been around for a very long time.
Yeah, one of the longest serving senators in U.S. history. You know, I'll revive the stump speech that I gave for the first few months of 2020, which was that Biden came out of a kind of precarious middle class family that at times was doing really well. At other times, his dad fell in hard times for a variety of reasons. I think that partly shaped his worldview. He obviously grew up in Delaware, heavily a segregated state, state with a lot of a history of racism, and by the time that he was really coming into his political career, those tensions around race and racial divisions were really coming to a head. He was initially a Newcastle County council member. His big selling point was that he was, you know, young, charming, good looking. All of that stuff, you know, kind of superficial things. When he ran for the Senate, he ran against a very old and elder statesman of Delaware politics, and no one expected that he would win. He, I think, ran as a way to kind of raise his profile, but because he was so young, because he had this, you know, politician's charisma, he was able to get people on board and get people excited for his run. And he raised a lot of small dollars. He ran on a kind of sort of wishy-washy anti-Vietnam platform. First, he kind of, you know, just didn't take a very firm stance one way or another. Then as time went on, he kind of went more into the firmly pro-withdrawal camp. And, you know, most interestingly, I think for the way that we think of Joe Biden now and the way that his career went, he ran on this kind of New Deal-ish platform that was almost, you know, you look at kind of what Bernie Sanders was saying in 2020 and 2016, and what Biden was saying then wasn't that dissimilar. He was talking about starting a consumer protection agency. He was talking about, you know, the billionaire, you know, not so much the billionaires, but the millionaires and big business and all the billion-dollar corporations and how they were dodging taxes and all this kind of thing. So, you know, ran on a actually a fairly progressive campaign. He won. And for the first few years, he kind of stuck to that messaging. And then, you know, as wider political conditions in the United States really shifted, so you saw things in Delaware really get crazy around the issue of busing. Biden, who until then he had said anti-busing things, but you know, he had always voted the liberal line on busing. Mm-hmm. Now, to save his political skin, he sees that politics is changing. He becomes, you know, the most fervent anti-busing politician, you know, maybe in the country. I mean, you know, outside of the South, at least. And he starts also talking about the need to cut spending. That becomes a big thing because, you know, inflation is rising. The narrative becomes that the reason inflation is out of control is because of all these crazy government programs. He actually puts forward a bill, what he calls a sunset bill, which basically provides for, I think, every 5 years, every single federal program has to be reauthorized by Congress. It's an insane, extreme bill that was called as such at the time, but that's the kind of way he's going forward. By the 80s, he really transitions to that the Reagan style of politics, because that's where politics is heading as a whole. And he really, for the next, you know, three decades, really until now, kind of becomes one of the main conservative anchors of the Democrats, always pushing them to go right, always pushing them in a more Reaganite direction on foreign policy, on domestic spending, on entitlement programs, and so on and so forth. And, you know, I mean, that's ultimately why part of the reason why he was chosen by Obama to be vice president, mm-hmm. because part of the idea was, well, you know, people are worried. I'm a young black guy. I'm kind of liberal. Well, therefore, I'll pick this conservative dinosaur from Delaware to assuage the kind of more conservative elements of the voting public. And then, of course, Biden becomes vice president, and really just being off being vice president, off being kind of Obama's most visible friend and ally for 8 years, really gives him this affection, I think, among some core sections of the Democratic Party voting different segments of it. And that really, I think, is what made him such a threat to Sanders, even though I think, you know, we could all agree that Biden was not quite the man he was through most of his career. When he ran in 2019, 2020, people had a lot of affection for him because they thought of him as, this is Obama's guy, this is Obama's best friend, and we love Obama. And there you have it. That's where we are now.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting looking at, I guess, now, like the early days of the Biden administration, is seeing his, like, ability maybe to see which way the wind's blowing and at least see where there's appetite within the party, maybe not necessarily for action, but for, like, reference. Matt and I, like, have been calling him the press release president, because he's been very good at, you know, sort of really, you know, not pivoting in policy to the left, but sort of in, like, rhetoric at times in a way that is quells, like, I don't know, the more progressive base of the Democratic Party. Well, when it comes to delivering, not really, you know, showing up. And before we get into the most current chapter, I was just curious, like, do you think, because we see within Biden's history that he has had all of these, you know, significant shifts, right, from his earliest days to his sort of, you know, the vast majority of his career when he's sort of a Reagan Democrat, to this kind of, you know, being sort of tied up with the Obama wing of the Democratic Party. Do you think that there is sort of, like, a deep ideological core to Bidenism, or do you think that he's an opportunist at this point?
I think he's very opportunistic. I think there is some ideological core to him. I mean, you know, I didn't quite buy all this stuff that people were saying through 2020, where they're saying, well, you know, he just goes wherever the wind blows. I mean, I don't think that's completely true. He has always been and always sold himself as a more conservative Democrat. It is true that he has shifted with the times, as I think most politicians do. You know, I mean, even Trump signed an eviction ban and reauthorized it, which is incredibly radical compared to previous presidents. But, you know, that doesn't mean that Trump is necessarily some sort of, you know, FDR 2.0. He did what he felt like he had to do to win an election and to keep his approval ratings high. So I think it's a similar thing with Biden. I think he is an opportunist, as most politicians are. He's not unique in that. I think that where his ideological core is, if we can sort of define some sort of Bidenism, is this idea of the middle class. You know, I mean, that is obviously shaped, I think, by his childhood, where he came out of. And I think it's also shaped by the political era that he came out of, where, you know, a lot of the time when he talks about the middle class, especially in the 70s and the 80s, he was talking about a very specific thing. He was talking about a very specific version of the middle class. He meant kind of white suburbanite voters, the kinds of people that ended up going Reagan's way. And you know, the thing that he used to tell people in the 80s was, you know, you don't want to sacrifice the middle class on the altar of all these different special interests, by which special interests he means, you know, he meant black people and Latinos and poor people and LGBTQ people and all those different kinds of demographics. And so, you know, I think this kind of idea of trying to anchor policies in the sense of what are they going to do for the middle class, is, I guess, how I would describe Bidenism. I think he has also that kind of what we might call kind of blue collar or working class kind of identity politics, where he sort of adopts certain, he'll say certain things, or he'll adopt certain kind of cultural characteristics that we might associate with kind of blue collar white workers, and you know, kind of take that on as a way to identify with people. That the Amtrak thing, of course, famously rode a train to and fro. I think that was really key to his persona for a long time. Made himself kind of an everyman, and of course, you know, he always bragged about, you know, I'm the poorest guy in the Senate. I never made any sort of money, which it's kind of true to an extent. You know, I think it's a little.
Obama famously loaned him some money when he was VP, right? And they made a big deal about that.
Yeah, because his son was in hospital and he was racking up medical bills. You know, ironically, one of the tragedies of that is the reason his son probably got the brain tumor that he did was because he was in Iraq, which of course is a war that Biden worked very hard to make possible. You know, that sort of tends to get elided from his biography a little bit, that you know, he really paved the way for the war that ended up creating his son's fatal disease. But I think that, you know, to the point that we can, to the extent that we can narrow down some sort of Bidenism, that's how I would describe it. And I think the Biden right now that we're seeing is very different to the Biden of the last 40-50 years. It's a better Biden, but I think we're learning that in this era, a better Biden is not really enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I just was reminded of the Kamala Harris exchange in the debates where she brought up the busing issue to hit him on and to sell merchandise on. But then after it developed for a few days, she didn't actually have anything structural to provide in this. And we've always been saying, like, look at what he does on the structural things, like the minimum wage or the PRO Act or healthcare expansion, like this sort of stuff. And he's basically came up lame in all those attempts so far. Voting rights, another one, like they're just not on the table. And I feel like just that says a lot about where this Democratic Party is now. It's a point where it can elaborate like the fight against fascism or, you know, the saving democracy, but not even remotely, because I guess because they're afraid of, like you're saying, like the middle class, I guess older middle class, I would think, like, I don't know. How do you explain that disconnect?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's kind of the classic Democratic thing, which is, you know, especially over the last 4 years, you use kind of maximalist rhetoric and you say all this stuff, but you don't really believe it. You know that the people that you're selling it to believe it. Mm-hmm. And so you are trying to sound like them because you want them to vote for you. But in the end, do they really think democracy was at stake? I mean, you know, if Biden really believed that this was kind of U.S. democracy's last gasp right now, why would the argument be, well, we can't get rid of the filibuster because we need it in case the Republicans take power? Mm. Well, you've been saying that there is no next time, the Republicans, when they take power, that'll be it. That'll be the end of democracy. So holding something in your back pocket like that is completely pointless. I would maybe add one thing, actually, you know, what you were saying about how a lot of the structural stuff hasn't really changed that much. You know, maybe one thing that we could say is a core of Bidenism to the extent that it exists, is that certainly the way he pitched himself in this campaign, and he sort of said things like this previously, where, you know, the idea is it's this class warfare stuff is wrong. He said this in the 2000s. Mm-hmm. He gave this interview, I think in 2003, and he said, this whole thing that people are saying that you know, you need to do class warfare and stuff, that's a terrible idea. You know, what Clinton did in the 90s, that's where the country is. That's where you need to go. You don't need all this ridiculous populism stuff. And in 2017, as he was kind of gearing up for a run, he did that famous speech to that hedge fund conference where he basically said to a bunch of Wall Street finance people, I need you. I need your help. You know, mm-hmm. nothing will fundamentally change. That's where that famous line comes from. He told them nothing's going to change. But, you know, if we can just sort of tinker around and find the right balance where you don't have to sacrifice all that much and we give just enough to, you know, certain groups and we fix things and we educate people enough and the workforce gets back to where it is, then everything will be fine. And we can basically just keep going as we've been going. And that's kind of what he's tried to do as president. You know, conspicuously, a lot of the things that he and the party have kind of given up on are the things that really were probably most threatening to donors, to big business, which of course gave very handsomely to Biden's campaign, has been lobbying very hard, you know, through his whole year. Things like the $15 minimum wage, things like the public option, which has just completely disappeared. No one even mentions it anymore. You know, so it's all, you know, it's things like childcare and universal pre-K, they are very good, but those are things that are, you know, in common benefit both working people and also businesses. You know, that is also very, very helpful for businesses. So he's tried to do that. I mean, it hasn't really worked out so far. So, I guess we're seeing the fruits of that approach.
Yeah. And I mean, I was about to say not to be too cynical, but you really do have to be cynical when you're watching the Democrats in office. Like, there is a bit about this whole saga that we're watching right now that is sort of, I don't know, I think that it's probably is going to come back to bite them in the ass, but you can also see a strategy here where we'll look at all these things that we can say, like, we were so close to being able to get all these extremely popular policies in place, but what we actually need is just another shot, you know, a big sweep in 2022, you know, to be able to put these things into place. I wanted to play this clip from today for you, actually, and sort of get your reaction to it, because it really hits on a lot of the ways that he's talking about, I don't know, class in the United States and, you know, his popular support here. I get it.
This. For too long, working people of this nation, the middle class in this country, the backbone of the country, have been dealt out. It's time to deal them back in. I ran for president.
Some West Wing moment.
I ran for president saying it was time to rebuild the backbone of the nation. And by that, I was very precise. The middle class has been the backbone of this nation.
Backbone.
I couldn't have been any clearer. That's why I wrote both these bills in the first place and took them to the people. I campaigned on them. The American people spoke. They have no doubt about what I ran on. Both these bills were all what I talked about. But guess what? 81 million people voted for me. This. For too long, working people.
Hold up, sorry. Yeah, I mean, I'm curious what your reaction to the way that he's talking right there about this kind of this. I mean, like he obviously when he gives, you know, talks to reporters and stuff, he's going to hit up a certain kind of rhetoric. But this was an interesting moment because I don't know. I feel like it fizzles a lot when you watch it. But this is like Biden trying to do almost like an FDR style thing where he's like calling upon all the people who supported him to, you know, to stand up and to encourage people to finally push through the gridlock. But it's, I don't know, it's that kind of like Sleepy Joe version of it that I don't really think is going to move the ball very much.
Yeah, I mean, what is he really doing? I mean, I feel like in this whole thing, he's present because you read about him or you'll see a speech from him. But is he really doing anything remotely like what FDR did. I mean, a few weeks back, a month or so ago, Sanders did this tour around certain red states. He went to Indiana, he went to Iowa, and I think actually he went to Michigan, which is a red state, but, kind of a purplish state. And he was trying to sell the bill. What he was saying recently about how people don't know what's in it, he was trying to go directly to these places, to Trump country, and say, hey, this is what is in here, and this is how it's going to improve your life, and this is why you should actually care about this. I mean, I don't, Biden's done speeches here and there, but it's bizarre to me that Sanders, Biden sort of takes credit for the bills that he says, I wrote these bills and I campaigned on them. But compared to what Sanders has been doing, Biden's really been kind of in the background.
Biden specifically, like when he had Jen Psaki say, we're looking at a reconciliation bill and not the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill, that's him not taking ownership of it and basically saying, we're going to whittle this stuff away.
Yeah, I mean, totally. And I think it's worth thinking right now as basically his presidency seems to be kind of teetering on the brink of failure, because this big, massive transformational bill that he promised is looking like it's going to get cut to pieces. Mm-hmm. Why is this happening? Because a few months ago, like I told you, I was thinking to myself, okay, I was wrong. And I'm pretty happy that I was wrong, because he seems to be kind of heading somewhere. And after he passed that relief bill, there was this real momentum behind his presidency. You know, he had the media fully behind him, which is obviously very important. They were just pumping out constant hagiography and constant kind of, press releases basically in his favor, and his approval ratings were high. People felt like it was, he was really doing this FDR thing, even if really, he wasn't quite as ambitious, but okay. And that would have been the perfect time to keep pushing and to go, okay, we passed this thing. Now let's go further. Let's use this moment to use this momentum to do the very difficult thing and get all 50 Democrats in the Senate on board with this even more expansive thing. That was a moment when Joe Manchin, who now, I know he's denied it, but there was that report that he's even thinking about leaving the Democratic Party now. But at that time, Manchin, completely unprompted, I believe, floated something like $4.5 trillion for an infrastructure bill, which is even higher than the compromise that Sanders ended up with that's going to get cut now. And I think it's because everything was sort of in Biden's favor. And unfortunately, he frittered it away, because what did he do? He said, well, I also want to prove to people that we can still do things together, bipartisan, still come together. And then months went by with just them screwing around, essentially trying to do this other bill that was basically part of that bill, but they split it off so that they can prove that they could get 10 Republicans on board. And all the momentum was lost. All these other kind of festering problems came to the fore, because coronavirus kind of came back. There were some mistakes in terms of the administration's pandemic response. There was the Afghanistan withdrawal, which I support, and I know you guys did too. But that took a lot of political capital, and at that point, the media completely turned against him. And so all the cards that he was holding, he basically threw them away. And of course, now Manchin, who maybe was predisposed to support something more ambitious, I think probably looked at this and went, "Well, this guy's sort of tanking. Not only do I feel no pressure to support what he wants, but I also kind of maybe it's not even a good thing for me to support what he wants, because this is not going well." Now this is where we are now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and where we are is like. Is an interesting and open question. I'm really curious as to your thoughts on this. I will just say, like, my prescription, one thing that is making me a little bit worried is as we're trying to build, a stronger socialist movement and trying to bring people into, like, thinking of themselves potentially as democratic socialists, etc. How closely tied that movement might seem to, what seems like it might be a sinking ship, which is this reconciliation package and the infrastructure bill, right? In the sense that, like, well, it's really important that Bernie's out there fighting to, to get the things that we can get. we don't want to also be tied too much to, you know, a failed political project that might be Bidenism. But beyond that, I wanted to sort of ask your thoughts on this, because there were those initial, like, oh Lord, he's FDR reincarnated. He's reluctant, but he's going to do it big. And it's funny now to hear all these complaints coming from Biden, and I know from Bernie as well, that the way that the media talks about these packages is by their price tag alone. But I have to say, especially early on, that was how a lot of progressive and, you know, squishy progressive journalists were talking about it, in the sense that this is a break from old school neoliberalism. This is a break from, like, austerity politics. They're willing to spend a lot of money, and now we might be in some kind of new era of capitalism. I mean, do you think that that's a fair sort of claim against the, you know, some of the people who were sort of writing these big stories about Biden during that time?
I suspect that the reason those stories were being written was the kind of, you know, regular liberal Democrats, I think, were fully on board with whatever Biden wanted to do, because he was the guy that beat Trump. And also they just kind of wanted to pretend like everything was fine now. And I think that those pieces were more kind of like, we need to get the lefty people on board. We have to convince them and see, look, I mean, look how huge these spending bills that he's proposing are. That's a real difference from before. And I mean, in terms of what it represents, you know, whether it's a new world or not, I mean, I think this entire time after, you know, through the pandemic, you know, even when Trump was in power to now, I think we're in the middle of something new being born. I don't know quite what that is. It's clear that, I mean, when the IMF is consistently talking about, you know, forgetting about deficits and better social spending and, you know, creating a kind of robust social safety net, I think presumably because they're looking at the sort of threats to democracy from what has happened over the last 40 years. I think that something has changed, obviously. But I don't think it's quite to the scale that some people are saying. I don't think we're, you know, we're in some sort of radically different stage than where we were before. I think some of the rules have changed, and some of the rules also that kind of govern how we thought about politics or how we should structure society are kind of vulnerable, if not kind of crumbling. And I think that presents opportunities. But I don't think we're there yet. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that Biden felt pressured enough by kind of right-wing attacks to let unemployment insurance, you know, go by the wayside, I think that's a really good example of that. You know, clearly some of the old rules are still there, and they're still fighting to be heard.
I mean, like on that, and like the eviction moratorium, all of these things that were under threat, you know, there were some, like, I don't know, kind of slight defenses you were seeing from Biden and the team there. But I mean, you know, just going back to some of the FDR, you know, comparisons, like, these things were extremely damn popular with people. Also, so were the stimulus checks. And I feel like there is a real missing of the moment from Biden and his team. I mean, like, you know, I'm not trying to give out too much free advice to political opponents, but, you know, you say we own these things. These are what we deliver to you. And, you know, these are things that are popular with folks across the board. They're popular here in Texas. And all that you saw was this real desire to, I don't know, run away from them, or, I don't know, give these kind of weak defenses for them. I do think I agree with you that, like, sort of shows that, yeah, we probably haven't entered into a new era yet.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, and also, To a large extent, I mean, I, on the one hand, yes, I've been surprised at how, I guess, progressive Biden's been, you know, compared to the Biden of old. But it's also, when you take stock of what Trump did and what Biden's done, I mean, a lot of what he's done is pretty conservative. I mean, that relief bill had a lot of spending, had a lot of, you know, individually good programs that weren't maybe huge structural changes, but we, you know, were designed to kind of rectify historical injustices to deal with the crisis at that time, as the pandemic was raging and you know, the economy was shot. But I mean, in terms of, you know, kind of permanent stuff, as people point out, that relief bill didn't do anything permanent. It did the child tax credit for a year. That was it. Biden had to be pressured to do the eviction moratorium to renew it, to actually even fight to try and renew it, which is just Trump's policy. I mean, you know, and you would think a guy who was the new FDR would kind of go above and beyond what his like very right wing predecessor did. But it's basically, and the other thing that Biden did, of course, was the $2,000 checks or the $1,600 checks.
Asterisk.
and you know, I mean, listen, those were good, those were popular, but again, that was done under Trump. I mean, it's kind of stunning to me how much his administration has been a continuation of Trump in those ways and also in the bad ways, immigration and
yeah, I mean, the border here. You know, no, I mean, I'm telling people that, I mean, obviously Biden is somebody whose political vision I very much reject, and I think that it's important for socialists not to get, I don't know. I think it's really important at times to make sure it's very, very clear that we view these people as political opponents. But I will say that there are a lot of things that are very frightening for the future that I've been looking at. I don't think people have really reckoned with enough. You look like what happened here in Texas in 2020, when everybody was talking a big game that he might be able to pick up the state potentially. Let's not even talk about what happened in the state house here, which was an absolute disaster. But you look at, you know, South Texas, you look at the Rio Grande Valley, and Trump was able to eat into the Democratic Party strongholds in Hispanic communities there. And everybody, you know, sort of, I don't know, forgot about it because obviously the news cycle moves quickly. But when they went in and they talked to people why you switch your vote from typically voting Democrat to voting for Donald Trump of all people, right? You live on the border, you're a person who's he's accusing of all these horrible things. People would say things that are very basic. It's like, hey, you know, those relief checks are very helpful. Hey, these kind of like emergency programs are really helpful. And it worries me a lot that there's been this kind of, I don't know, rejection of like really highlighting that in Biden's politics and even for the Democratic Party at a national level, while also seeing the places where they were winning was doing this kind of, I don't know, cultural stuff, credentialist stuff, where they were able to win in the South in particular, were in these kind of wealthier, more traditionally Republican, you know, suburbs, right? And I'll tell you one thing about those voters, they're not loyal at all to the project of, you know, building, you know, mild liberalism. So I think that the thing that's really worrying about Biden is like, one, in the short term, like he's not delivering on these things that we really desperately need. I mean, this fact that we're not being able to get a significant addressing of like climate change.
Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of hits on an important point, which is part of the reason why he's in the bind that he is now, and the party's in the bind that it is now. You know, it has these really narrow margins, particularly in the Senate during an election year where everyone thought this was, you know, they were going to pick up you know, some seats. And in the end, I think the fatal mistake was, and this is absolutely baffling, and I think it's going to be one of these things that people talk about for a long time, especially if Biden's going to presidency ends up floundering, as it looks like it is the decision to cancel in-person door knocking. The thing that Obama famously staked his campaign on, he cited and his campaign cited as the reason that he had won those victories, and they said no, but you know, for the sake of coronavirus, even though there was I would say no real safety issues with door knocking in a pandemic, as long as you were masked, as long as you were able to, you know, keep within 6 feet away or so, they canceled it. And that was all these different Democratic officials around the country, including in Texas, they cited that as the specific thing that lost them, not just Senate seats, but state house seats all over the country, which of course now has put the Republican Party in this position where they can gerrymander the way to power for another 10 years. There was this decade long, multi-million dollar campaign by the Democrats. They had this plan. They were going to, you know, on this election, they were going to win a bunch of state houses and stop the GOP from doing what they did 10 years ago. And they failed. And it was because of the Biden campaign and the decision they made, absolutely baffling decision. Meanwhile, Trump, of course, his campaign read the Obama book, quite literally. Mm-hmm. And they just followed what he did, and they went door knocking everywhere. And, you know, lo and behold, a massive turnout for Trump at a time when he was absolutely running the country into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that's just, it's just this cascading series of bad decisions and failures that you know, are now leaving us where we are right now.
Well, it's because they're fundamentally, the Democratic Party is fundamentally awkward with democracy, right? Like, we've talked about this before, like the Republicans, their goal is to repress democracy. The Democrats should be to cultivate it, but instead they just think we're going to like manage it somehow.
Mm.
And fundamentally, like, yeah, you're afraid of your own base, and you expect you can get them out with, you know, Facebook ads and stuff like that.
yeah, exactly. I mean, which also fits completely with what I think has really infected the Democratic mind over these last 4 years, which is that this idea that the reason everything that's happened has happened is because of Facebook memes, mm-hmm. and because of bots, mm. and social media. And you know, that's why Bolsonaro won. It was because of tech companies and social media. It's why Trump won. Every single thing bad and good gets ascribed to this, which is of course completely ridiculous, but very much reflective of that mindset that you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's important for people to spend some time looking at those memes that have been put out. They're absolutely ludicrous, and they're not really convincing anybody. And that's, I don't know, you're coming up with very complex, very simple solutions to complex issues. And I don't know, but even at times they're not that complex, because, like, I don't know, in Texas, they were literally, people were calling up the state party office here in Texas and saying, something's happening in South Texas. Can you please send some fucking people, or at least get a billboard or something? And the calls went unanswered, right? So there are plenty of people telling them what they can be doing to sort of get out of this current.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that this is what happened. I think it mostly is just incompetence. But, you know, some people got angry at me when I said during the 2020 election that I thought the kind of top of the Democratic Party, the very elite, would have much rather, you know, had another 4 years of Trump than have a Bernie Sanders presidency. Mm-hmm. And I mean, to be honest, I think I was vindicated. I don't know if you've read the book Lucky, which was a kind of behind the scenes account of Biden's campaign by two Hill journalists, actually one Hill journalist, one NBC journalist, you know, establishment media people. And that's basically, they didn't say it outright, but that's certainly the impression they gave. And in fact, actually, no, I think there was even a line in there that you know, there was a group of Democrats that were talking about how, you know, another 4 years of Trump, they could make it through that. But, oh, God.
Honestly, to me, that's the most, like, honest, like, okay, so seeing whether we're going to cut Obamacare versus whether we're going to get infrastructure packages, I think a marginal improvement. But the most emotionally resonant reason for me for, like, preferring a Democrat in office is because of that, exactly that. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they prefer to, like, be in opposition and, you know, wear kente cloths and take knees and say, we're going to do all this stuff. We're going to save democracy. We're going to, you know, we're even going to take a look at reparations. We're going to promise all this stuff that is really just email content for fundraising emails, right? And that's like, when I get into somebody who's like, why should I care? It's like, well, mainly that, because it's annoying when they're in opposition and they pretend they're going to do something different.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly all the financial incentives in the world are weighted towards that kind of thing. You know, whether it's that kind of cottage industry of consultants and election people that are just, you know, fundraising of kind of terrifying older Democratic voters, or even Congress people, you know, who go off and retire. Well, they retire from politics, and then they go and become lobbyists, or they become, you know, they join corporate boards. Of course, it's a lot harder to do that if you have spent any amount of time kind of alienating those interests by kind of passing legislation that happens to hurt their bottom line. So, of course, you know, the incentives are not really there. Having said that, I don't think, some people that would argue right now what we're seeing, oh, the Democrats always wanted this. You know, they're just, this is all a kind of kabuki theater. I don't believe that. I think they have clearly internalized, some of them have clearly internalized the lessons of Obama. and kind of some of the cases that have been made by people like Reed Hunt and also people on the left, that basically by doing too little and failing to really live up to his promises, that people got disillusioned and, you know, things fell apart and you got Trump. And also a bunch of Democrats were thrown out of office. So I think that there is a you know, they're cognizant of that. But, you know, I think we would also have to be foolish to completely rule out the very, very strong financial incentives that exist to, you know, not do anything.
Yeah, right. They're riding two horses now. One says, like, try to learn some lessons about politics. And the other says, you know, coerce people so they have to work for capitalists. And they're going to pick one of those horses as they start to diverge, I guess.
Well, Bronco, I really appreciate you taking the time this evening to talk to us. People should definitely check out your writings in Jacobin, and also read the book Yesterday's Man. It's a really phenomenal read.
Yeah, I highly recommend it for anybody trying to make sense of this all right now. If you have somebody asking questions like, why does Biden suck? There's your answer.
Well, I appreciate that.
All right, well, take care.
You too, guys.
No, that was sweet. I got freaked out for a second. I thought the motorcycle's coming from somebody's place where, like, a horrible feedback loop. Like ghosts were attacking for a second.
That was a powerful, that sounded like a
big fight. Those were some big boys. There's some big hogs out there. No, really, Yesterday's Man is a phenomenal book. And Bronco's writings in Jacobin on all sorts of subjects are really phenomenal. I can't suggest people follow his work enough.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's essential reading. There's a few people who, you know, like Eric Weinstein, the Weinstein brothers talk about like the sense making community and stuff like that. Like, Franco's part of the actual sense making community, I would say.
No, for sure. Well, we got a couple things to get before we go to the post game. Just reminding people, we're getting close to 1,000 patrons over there. It'd be really great if we could hit it before my birthday on Sunday. Might be shooting a little high there, but it would be really, really nice to wake up to Sunday. We're also trying to get Matt Leck out here to Austin, Texas for us to do our inaugural barbecue stream. So that's what will be coming once we hit 1,000 patrons. There's plenty of bonus content on there. There are deep dives into theory. We have our radical history series where we've gone in depth with really wonderful people like Paul O'Connell and Milton Alemani, people like James Connolly and Walter Rodney. Like, you definitely are going to want to get that. We have a lot of fun too. We have our think tanks, which we do the first week every month. We have bonus episodes each week. On top of that, you get the post game where Matt and I sort of hang out for a little bit, watch some clips of weird right wingers, drink a beer, and answer your questions. So definitely sign up and join us at patreon.com/leftreckon.
Today we're going to be talking about Third Way Harambe. Actually, I'm excited. You haven't seen this, have you, Dave?
I have not seen this. So Matt's always introducing me to the weird things on the internet. I mean, it's not like I don't spend enough time there, but Matt has an in.
Yeah, I got a little oracle into some dumb stuff, including this is a little bit less obscure, but Third Way Harambe is not obscure. It's where that, you know, that girl who was going to stand up to the bowl in Wall Street.
Oh yeah, the little girl or whatever.
Yeah, that solved the patriarchy. So yeah. Now Harambe is going to solve inequality.
Oh boy!
By offering a third way that makes capitalism work for everybody,
or something like that.
Yeah, no. I'm excited about that, and also I'm excited to show David AOC's Challenger. That's going to be fun as well.
But I've not seen enough of that yet. No plenty to do. Also, I'm going to be we'll do a segment on this next week, but I do just want to shout out really quick for people who are here in Austin. There is an important election coming up here. It's one of those kind of similar stories where the right wing is really fixated on, you know, sort of getting around democracy by you know, putting very important ballot measures in low turnout elections. And we're facing that here. There's a Proposition A, which needlessly is going to increase the police department budget here in Austin by something like $600 million to hire more police officers. It's something that I believe even the interim police chief has said that, you know, is not really what they need, right? Because it's actually dictating what they do with the money. Now, I don't want to listen to cops too much on the show, but I just think people should understand that this is a really absurd proposition that is essentially being used to clandestinely gut other programs. Because if you increase these city budgets, that means cuts have to come elsewhere. That means cuts to fire. That means cuts to EMS. That means cuts to parks, libraries, etc. So yeah, we'll talk. I think I'll do a full thing, sort of breaking it down for people. But I want to put up. I'm just pulling up the chats here for people to check out. A website where you can go and volunteer or donate. And if you're in Austin, you know, early voting is going on right now. Election day is on November 2nd. So definitely be sure to try to get involved, because this is the kind of thing that they do. You know, they sort of rile people up on Nextdoor about, you know, a crime wave, and they get, you know, older, wealthier folks to come out and vote and make decisions that, you know, bind the city. You know, and have lots of consequences for the rest of us. So I want to make sure we're paying attention to that. I'm gonna put these in the chat for people right now.
Cool. Yeah, good job, David, for getting out there and phone bank and doing some.
Yeah, I did phone bank the other day. I definitely phone bank if you can. It's like, it's always such a it always feels like it's gonna be worse than it is. Actually, it was. I had a really nice time talking to folks yesterday.
Yeah, I remember. I honestly haven't done it since Bernie's 2016 primary. But, you know, calling people up cold and being like, "Hey, I'm calling from Bernie," and to hear excitement from just a random person, it's awesome.
You get more excitement than you expect, and it's also interesting to hear. I don't know. Maybe I think about politics a little bit differently than other folks, but like, it's interesting to hear what people are like. Just, I don't know, genuinely saying to you, they don't know who you are. And where they're thinking, what's motivating them at a specific time, I think can be really beneficial.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but yeah, anyways, very, very crucial election. Okay. I'm pulling something up for us. Matt, could you sort of set us up on this India Walton thing? I'm pulling up the video.
Yeah. Right, so, let me grab one little detail thing before.
Yeah, no worries. But, also, help us get to a certain level so we can have a producer.
Yeah, I know. So we don't have to keep like learning different workflows every time we change a. This is a man by the name of it's New York's Democratic Party. Fucking intelligence are not ordering information with that. What's the pyramid? The most important information. Here it is. Jay Jacobs, party chair, New York Democrats, is asked a question that people are asking a lot of people, Chuck Schumer, like, hey, you're not endorsing India Walton. Do you want to specify a reason for that? And rather than specify an actual reason for not endorsing India Walton for Buffalo mayor, they like to get a little bit philosophical. Oh, and so here is here's a little thought experiment from party chair.
I think it then leads you to the question, is it always a requirement of a Democratic elected official or perhaps the state chair or party chairs? Is it a requirement that if someone wins the Democratic primary, they must always get the Democratic endorsement of these people? And that question I would answer, no, it's not. Look, let's take a scenario very different. Where David Duke, you remember him, the Grand Wizard of the KKK, he moves to New York, he becomes a Democrat, and he runs for mayor in the city of Rochester, which has a low primary turnout, and he wins the Democratic line. I have to endorse David Duke? I don't think so. Now, of course, India Walton isn't in the same category, but it just leads you to that question, is it a must? It's not a must.
Yes.
It's something you choose to do. That's why it's an endorsement.
So... Of course, it doesn't lead you to that question. I'm getting a little bit of maybe I'll clean it up. It does not lead you to that question. You can actually answer the question, because clearly it's not a requirement, because all these motherfuckers don't want to endorse India Walton, and they're not doing so. So there's not, because he's not acting like, oh, you're not following the requirements. Yeah, okay. we've passed the point of like the bourgeois right of a politician to endorse whom they want in, you know, infinite worlds of, you know, possibility. Why aren't you doing India Walton specifically? Answer that question. That's the question it leads to. It led to that question, and we're avoiding it by invoking David Duke.
And I mean, and that's exactly it. I mean, obviously the comparison there is insulting, frankly, to everybody involved. It's insulting to the state party there. It's insulting to India Walton,
the voters.
It's insulting to us just having to fucking listen to that bullshit. But it's also a kind of chicken shit thing, right? It's a coward's way of getting out of it, because what this person doesn't want to do is articulate the reasons why they do not support India Walton, right? For sure, you might be free to not endorse somebody, right, who's in your party, but you probably are going to be asked why. And in this case, the reason that this person doesn't want to endorse somebody like India Walton is because India Walton has run a campaign that is very much class-rooted, right? It's talking to people. It's not just talking to people in like language in terms that they understand. It's being in the same communities as them. It's seeing the same kind of things as them, and it's trying to find a way to articulate those demands and frustrations that people have into winning politics, right? Which is a threat to the state Democratic Party in New York, right? Because that's the kind of politics that, when we talk about the Democratic Party functionally just existing to manage democracy, this is a real threat to it. When you start having people mobilization in a community, and it's not something that you can go out and say that you're against, right? You can't say that you're against, you know, doing something about the affordability crisis and rent. You can't say that you're against wanting to do more to address, you know, unjust outcomes in policing, right? You can't say that you're against wanting to increase the minimum wage for workers, right? Like, these are basic things that are extremely popular, and the Democratic Party faints that, you know, that it's going to, you know, pursue those policies when in office. And as we're seeing across the board, they don't. But when somebody actually is looking like they're going to come into power who might deliver on those things, you have to come up with an absurd scenario for why you're not just going to endorse anybody. Own up to it, man. If you're going to be a little coward, if you're going to be a shill, if you're going to be somebody who is against people, say it. I'd have way more respect for you than this kind of bullshit nonsense.
You know, in Yesterday's Man by Bronco, Marsha Teach, who previous guest, in case we're watching this clip, mentions Joe Biden early on saying, I'm going to be a guy that says what he actually believes on things. And what he actually believed, what he was going to be honest about, was like, we should criminalize marijuana and be against busing. But at least he was honest about it, right? This thing where it's like, yeah, I mean, gosh, you know who thinks of Indy Walton is equivalent or in the same category as David Duke? The real estate industry, like all of these sort of moneyed interest donors, that's the equivalent. That's why he draws that equivalence. That's why it actually makes sense to them, because they actually think of India Walton as not part of us, as a, like David said, an absolute threat to us. And it's really revealing. And, you know, Hochul, the lieutenant governor or the governor now, whatever, replacing Cuomo, also not taking a position. But it's more interesting that Chuck Schumer's not. Because like he said at the top of the cold open here, like, this isn't about politics. If you just went and just endorsed normal Democrats who win primaries, then there's nothing political about it. It's not a question you have to field. But all of a sudden you're going to be coy about it and not answer why. You're making it political. And it's because, you know, you're, like David said, against what she represents. Demon rats, man.
Yeah, I mean, demon rats is a great slogan. I'm so sad that the right wing came up with it, because it's phenomenal. Yeah, I mean, and also I'll say it time and time again, there probably is not a state Democratic Party in the country that is as rotten to the core as the New York State Democratic Party. I mean, that is a pay-to-play system. It is an organization that is almost completely overtaken by the real estate lobby, which is playing no small role in trying to come at somebody like India Walton. Remember that, like, you know, a lot of times we talk about the need to do local politics, which we do. But there's this kind of idea that it's somehow easier to win like local elections than, I don't know, state or national.
No,
it's not.
It takes a lot less money. You basically need to catch power sleeping, honestly. That's how you can win a local election. But if they actually want to come in, they're a lot cheaper to buy the smaller you get.
No, I mean, local governments across the country are completely bought and sold in large part by the real estate lobby. There's other interests, of course, but real estate in particular has a lot of control of these systems. And that's why people, Democratic, like progressives are threatening to that system, but like Democratic socialists are especially threatening to that system, because when we say things like, oh, rent is too much, we start to locate the actual reason that rent is too much. And that is because there's a predatory class sitting on top of our homes, just like sucking up value while the rest of us can't get into it, right? We start to name the capitalist class themselves, so landlords.
And so, I got to say, just to jump in there, like to see Charlie Kirk talk about, what's the group that's buying up all the homes?
I can't remember off the
Blackstone,
top of my head.
Whatever.
Oh, Blackstone?
Yeah, isn't that like buying up? Like, I see the right, like, occasionally make, and Will Witt, the PragerU kid, who's also like against like the giant conspiracy of everything to buy up all the homes for corporation. Like, this is a real issue. Mm-hmm. The real estate, like, that's relevant. I don't know anywhere that wouldn't be sort of something you don't want to tamp down on your political base if you're a political party that wants to win elections.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, before we get to the post game, I wanted to just
BlackRock. Sort of, sorry.
Oh yeah, BlackRock. Yeah, yeah.
Blackstone.
I think Blackstone is like a picture company.
Yeah.
I like that on-air correction. Before we go to the post game, there's one more story I wanted to touch on, just because I don't know. It talking seriously about Venezuela is something that we need to get a lot better at doing on the U.S. left. Beyond that, though, this is a really worrying area of Biden really starting to ratchet up pressure and sort of breaking down, relations that seem like they might have been getting to a point where they were cooling. So we'll do more on this in the future, but I want to just note a couple of quick things here. We're going to talk about Alex Saab, who is a Colombian businessman who has ties to Maduro in Venezuela. And I want to talk about the story briefly, and then I'm going to play a clip to show people how these stories are told to folks, and to just, I don't know, make the point that the ideological project of making everything seem as sinister as possible and obscuring United States interest in the actual implementation of imperialist policies, trying to obscure that relation. So just really briefly, and I'll be candid here. Alex Saab is a Colombian businessman who essentially has a relationship with Maduro and the Venezuelan government for one purpose. This is a guy who, I'm sorry, I know this might piss off some people, but I really don't have any doubt has a shady past and is involved in like shady dealings, right? This is a guy who the Venezuelan government works with to essentially get around the blockade and United States sanctions so that Venezuela can buy and sell things on international markets. So that means, by definition, this is somebody who is breaking the law, right? This means that this is somebody who does things like money laundering, right? And creating shell corporations. And I'm sure as hell, the person is taking money off of the top from it, right? This is not just coming from the goodness of their heart, right? I don't want to malign them too much, but I'm just saying that, like, if in the course of these, investigations, certain unsavory things come up, I want to remind people, it's like the reason that Maduro and the Venezuelan government engage with folks like this is because they are blockaded and they face brutal sanctions that prevent them from being able to do things like buy medicine, to be able to sell oil, and to be able to import food, right? Despite all the things that the United States says that they do not try to stop them from importing food, the United States sanctions certainly play a role.
I mean, put in the context of all the revelations we've had in like the past, I guess, decade now of tax avoidance, I think we can, say that maybe some positive upside as opposed to the people who just do it to have more money at the end of the day.
No, exactly. And also in the same way that like we employ people who do things that are unsavory, right?
Oh, do we?
I'm sorry, man. Not we're not to burst your bubble here.
We're missing ourselves, okay?
We have actually a few departments of people who do things that most people would consider, if not illegal, to be immoral.
a lot of the executive branch.
You know, these are the kind of people. This is what happens when you create, you know, when you create a regime of sanctions and blockade against the country, again, to try to eradicate a government that continues to win at the ballot box, right? So anyways, Alex Saab is somebody, he's a Colombian businessman with ties to Maduro, who gets arrested. I can't remember what island, but he was in the Atlantic off the coast of Africa. He gets arrested by Interpol and has now been extradited to the United States, where he is facing charges of graft, essentially, right? He was notably, he was on this trip. I can't remember if he was coming to or from Iran to secure a deal to import food and sell gas to the Iranians, right? Again, to try to get some funds and foodstuffs for the Venezuelan people. So that's what he was doing when the United States arrested him. It also should be noted that, you know, it seemed like the Biden administration was starting to cool on some level. The Trump, I don't know, saber rattling against Venezuela. But obviously this has thrown that out of the window. And of course, let's not forget that, you know, the United States still believes that that guy, Juan Guaido, who's always hanging out in parks around the country telling people that he's the president of Venezuela, somebody who is trying to steal gold from the people of Venezuela that the Bank of England has been holding and refusing to return to Venezuela. But the United States still thinks that that weird guy, you know, is trying to act like that guy is the president, right? So plenty of reason for there to be you know, for the relations between the United States and Venezuela to not be good, on top of the fact that the United States is engaged in essentially a mass economic terror campaign against the country. I want to share this clip here, and I'm sorry to make people watch MSNBC, but I just wanted to share this to respond to a little bit, but to also remind people how these kind of stories get presented to the U.S. public, right? Let me just give you my quick and dirty, you know, so nobody gets distracted, version of what this international incident, you know, turns out to be. Venezuela is a country that is essentially blockaded from international markets. They have a guy who they use, who's probably a bit shady, to help them secure deals so that they can get money into their country to be able to do basic things, especially during an ongoing economic crisis. Some of it, which is self-inflicted, but hell, a lot of it has to do with the United States blockade and sanctions against the country, right? The United States arrests the guy who is trying to help Venezuela get around the sanctions that the United States is setting up. And instead of it sort of being seen what it truly is, which is essentially the United States trying to come at, I don't know, an asset of the Venezuelan government, it's being acted like, oh, the good old United States has got another crook, you know, off of the streets. And and they don't understand why Maduro is so worried about this, other than the fact that maybe this guy has some dirty, dirty secrets. So let me pull this up really briefly. Sorry, I didn't have it. I should have had it set up a second ago. But I just think this is a really interesting segment here, because, I don't know, it really does show how, like, consent is manufactured. Just listen to the language. Listen to the language they use to describe the people in Venezuela, the language that they use to describe Maduro, et cetera, because I think it's really telling.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you have it ready, but I was just going to say, like, okay, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
You can
go.
Well, I was just going to say the pattern is, like, it's similar to Assange, right? Like, you don't have to even subscribe to everything in Assange's history to understand what's being done here.
Yeah.
This weekend, Alex Saab, a Colombian businessman and a close ally of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, was extradited to the United States. In response, the Venezuelan government suspended talks with the country's U.S.-backed opposition. Here with more is NBC's Ali Aruzi. Ali, the government of Venezuela is clearly scared of what Alex Saab could tell the U.S. authorities. Who is this guy?
Good morning, Jose. Well, we know he's a 49-year-old Colombian businessman of Lebanese origin. And as you mentioned, he's obviously very valuable to the Maduro government. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been so vocal about his arrest and extradition. Look, this is a man who's been doing hundreds of millions of dollars worth of deals with the Venezuelan government at a time when Colombia wouldn't go anywhere near them because of uncertainty over the financial markets in Venezuela, over hyperinflation and devaluation of their currency. Now, the Maduro government has essentially accused the U.S. of kidnapping Alex Saab when he was refueling his private jet in Cape Verde. It was making a refueling stop there when it was on its way back from Iran, a close ally of the Maduro government, on the way back to Venezuela. And as you mentioned, the government there have responded by suspending talks with the U.S.-backed opposition, which is only to the detriment of the Venezuelan people. And of course, they also arrested six Venezuelans, five of them have U.S. citizenships, who worked for a Houston-based oil refinery. Those six men were all under house arrest. They got transferred to prison as soon as Saab had been extradited. It's unclear whether the two incidents are connected, but the timing is certainly suspicious.
You're muted, David.
Yeah, there's a few things in there that, like, I think specifically the way that it's noted, right, that, like, the reason that they're worried about this is because they're worried that this guy will reveal some, like, embarrassing information about Maduro instead of the much clearer answer, right? You don't even have to, like, have a strong political opinion on Venezuela to sort of see what I'm saying here, is that, no, the reason the Venezuelan government is mad is because the guy who helps them do deals, right, has been picked up by the country that is preventing them from doing deals, right? I don't know. It's just like it's a very simple thing to me. But yeah, instead, you know, there's this implication that there's extra cynical, there's extra, like, dark secrets or skeletons in Maduro's closet, right? This is how you create a narrative in people's mind that, like, I don't know, other countries' leaders are thugs and criminals.
Right, yeah. The way you're acting in response to us, I don't know, kidnapping, maybe that's too strong, a person who's very important to you, proves that everything we say about you has been true all along.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it. And again, like, the point is not necessarily to say, I don't know, I don't want to malign him too much because he's doing things that are, you know, opening some doors for folks. But look, I have really no doubt that Saab is, you know, is not just an altruist or like a secret Marxist guerrilla, you know, trying to fight for the communes there either, right? I think that, you know, there definitely are things that can be uncovered. I'm sure that he's pulling money off the top, and I think that that's a bad thing, by the way. But I just think just not to be able to speak clearly about this shows just how much propaganda there is, when it comes to talking about Venezuela on the global stage, right? And they do everything that they can, to make it seem like this weak country that is under assault from all directions, is the aggressor, and the dangerous force. In global politics, when I'm sorry, it's the United States, which is working as hard as it can to try to prevent this country from being able to have just normal economic relations with other countries.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thanks everybody for hanging out with us. This has been a fun show. I really enjoyed talking about, like, not just Biden, but like Biden's, I don't know, political perspective, because I think people don't really talk about that too much. People see him as quite neutral. We got a lot coming. We got Harambe meme lord shit. We got some AOC's number one enemy. What else we got coming up in the post game?
Oh, I don't. That's the two things that are more foremost in my mind. I think there's a couple other things, but yeah. I mean, I'm most excited about Harambe and what this means for art. It's a new era. This is very much the third way Harambe art era. Just like 100 years ago, we were doing like Der Stiel or something mm-hmm. like that.
Exactly. Well, we also have good stuff coming up in the post game. We'll have Discord questions, and later this week we will be releasing. Can we talk about? Can we announce who our guest is for?
Elias Cepeda, yeah, he's got a Substack we can link to, but we're going to be talking about a couple things. Colin Powell, remembering him the way Donald Trump wants us to. Texas teachers we'll be talking about, and maybe some other topics. So a little bit more casual kind of all-around conversation with Elias. So
yeah.
Patreon.com/LeftReckoning to get that on Sunday.
All right. Well, I'll see you guys on the other side. And take care, everybody, and have a good weekend.
Peace.